This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. One of our stories this week went viral with tens of thousands of hits on our website, getting shared all over the country on social media. It was Kara Lofton's story describing an effort by a trauma nurse at UVA's medical center to encourage his medical colleagues to take a break, a pause, after the death of a critical care patient. You'll want to stay tuned for that, but we've also got a couple of stories about the music scene in Charlottesville, also a new crisis faced by local churches among the young, and we go all the way back 1 year ago to the first story out of the WMRA newsroom by Andrew Jenner. First, Sefe Imakpai learned about a resource for kids in Charlottesville providing an outlet for their music. The Music Resource Center is celebrating its 20th year.
It's a Saturday afternoon, and the Music Resource Center is hosting Blues, Beats, and Barbecue at the Ickes Art Park. It's an opportunity for the community to come together and learn more about the now 20-year-old facility that's serving Charlottesville's youth through music. Pia Donovan is executive director.
So Music Resource Center is a safe and diverse community experience. We're sort of a community center that focuses on music, and the kids can come in and learn a diverse set of skills, everything from the music they come to learn to the soft skills they don't come to learn but get anyway, community leadership, collaboration, responsibility, that kind of stuff.
The MRC boasts a fully equipped recording studio, 3 rehearsal rooms, 5 project studios, a dance studio, a performance hall, and almost every instrument you could think of.
Right down to the drumsticks, you just walk in the door and you're ready to go.
The center serves kids from 6th to 12th grade with a wide range of styles, including hip-hop, rock, and electronic dance music. In the early 90s, John Hornsby, who was a local musician at the time, wanted to provide a different outlet for kids to pursue in their free time.
We really saw a lot of kids falling through the cracks in after-school time, and what he saw happening was kids joining Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, playing sports, doing all kinds of other things, but there wasn't really a place for kids to do music. So he started doing surveys of local high school and middle school kids, and part of the survey was, you know, what do you like to do? What do you do after school? And if you were able to go to a center that provided everything for you musically, would you do that? 90% of the kids answered that they'd be there 3 or 4 days a week.
And now they are. Doors opened in 1995, and today the Music Resource Center has more than 200 members and another 300 kids they serve through community outreach programs in the city of Charlottesville. Donovan says in the next 20 years, they now hope to find a way to measure their progress and be able to use numbers and data to signify what effect the MRC has had on the community's youth.
Right now, we're in a phase of formalizing everything. We're putting in a measurement system. We've built out a customized member tracking system. We're working with the schools and the police department to compare data. So at the end of this year, we'll be able to look at our statistics quarterly and say, okay, we've served this many kids. They've spent this many hours in here. Their grades have done this.
The Music Resource Center releases a compilation album every year, and this year's 20th edition has been submitted for Grammy consideration in the children's category. Donovan says it's just one of the many examples of the talent that comes from the uniquely diverse group of members who utilize the center.
One of the kids told me recently, one of the things that's best about being at Music Resource Center is that I'm not a kid or a teenager that doesn't know. I'm just a fellow musician that the kids treat him that way, and the staff treats him that way. And so I think we're really providing a unique space for these guys.
Music can be heard at musicresourcecenter.org. For WMRA News, I'm Sefe Amokpai.
Let's stay in Charlottesville, and with the musical theme, there's one venue that offers a unique experience for the audience and for the bands that play at The Garage. Virginia Public Radio's Emily Richardson-Lorente checked it out.
I'm here in Lee Park in downtown Charlottesville, looking across the street at one of the most unusual art and music spots in town, The Garage.
Hey, hey, 1, 2, check, 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 hey, yeah.
I'm Kenny George, with the Kenny George Band from Aiken, South Carolina. It's my first time playing in Charlottesville.
Are you getting the guitar out there, too?
We've done a lot of small stages. We've never done anything where we're just boxed in like that, though, so it ought to be pretty interesting.
The Garage has been hosting concerts and other art events for 7 years now. Sam Bush books the acts.
With the door closed, it looks just like any other single-car garage. But once 8 o'clock rolls around on any given summer night, you open the door. We've got a sound system and a band playing in there, and suddenly there's a concert going on.
Small town radio station, suddenly your feelings have changed.
The garage sits between a funeral home and the office of Christ Episcopal Church. The audience sits across the street on a low wall at the edge of Lee Park.
The busier and busier it gets, we spread up the hill, and you can dance at the bag, you can dance in the road if it's a quiet night.
Madeline Partridge has worked 24 shows since May.
People stop by, we put signs downtown, so they are like, oh, what's this, and just wander up the road.
Bill Stevens, for example, discovered the concert while walking his 5-year-old collie, Jack.
Well, I started off taking my dog for a walk, but I heard the music at the garage, and so I decided to walk by and see how good it was, and it turned out to be great, so we stuck around for the rest of the concert.
There are actually 3 dogs and about 70 people in the audience tonight. Among them, Lori Jean, Jake Milton, and Camden Littleton.
It's amazing to me that, like, awesome indie bands from around the country, like, really want to include this little tiny garage in middle of nowhere Charlottesville on their routes. So that tells you something about the value of this place. It's just always a wonderful thing to sit out in the grass under the trees and the stars and hear amazing music down in the little garage.
Where else are you going to come and sit on the side of a hill in a park downtown and see live music for free? Like, it's awesome.
It's a beautiful offering from Charlottesville, yeah. Right?
It's so cool.
Of course, having a road run between the band and the audience can be challenging, as Lori's friend Rachel Adams knows.
Usually you have cars driving right in front of the garage and sometimes multiple times circling the block looking for a parking spot and just completely clueless to the fact that they're driving through a live show.
But at the garage, that's all part of the charm. Again, Madeline Partridge.
There's birds and sirens and cars slowly going by, so it's all just very unique experience for bands, and most of them get on board.
In fact, Sam Bush says he gets about 15 emails a week from bands that want to play the garage. And even Kenny George, who wasn't so sure about this place 2 hours ago, has come around.
I'd definitely come back and play the garage in a heartbeat.
See y'all next time. Thanks so much.
I'm Emily Richardson-Lorente in Charlottesville.
Here's the story that's getting attention all over the country this week. It deals with how to handle a subject that we avoid whenever we can. Death. But death is a daily reality that hospital workers, especially emergency and trauma nurses, techs, and doctors have to deal with. Carol Lofton reports on one initiative called The Pause that started at the University of Virginia Medical Center a couple of years ago and is now slowly being adopted by hospitals all over the country.
What do you want? Where do you want your baby?
These sounds from an actual training clip from medic video on YouTube are reenacted every day in emergency rooms all around the country, including at the University of Virginia Medical Center. A stretcher, fresh off an ambulance, comes sweeping through the emergency room doors. EMTs, nurses, doctors, and techs run toward the patient, equipment, a room, scrambling, hoping to save the life. It is the irony of this moment, when the patient's life is slipping away, that they, the medical workers, feel so alive. Adrenaline makes them hyper-alert, and their own hearts pump faster, as if willing the heart and the body on the stretcher to keep pumping too. But they are too late. The patient dies, and there's someone else who needs saving. So they put down their tools, clean up, and move on. For the past 8 or 9 years, variations on this scenario have been trauma nurse Jonathan Bartel's reality.
At times, we couldn't save them. It started to wear on me at times, and staff responses were often frustration, disappointment, a feeling of failure. You could see pain in the physician's eyes. You see pain in the nursing staff.
In order to cope, he said, most medical professionals stop thinking of the person in the bed as a person, but rather just a body that they are trying to resuscitate. Disconnection, he acknowledges, is necessary on some level, but it can also be harmful and lead to burnout, a state he said he has experienced on more than one occasion. One day, about 2 years ago, after Bartel's team tried and failed to resuscitate a patient, a chaplain came into the room.
We had worked on this patient for hours, and the chaplain came in and kind of stopped everyone from leaving the room. And I'm like, wow, that's really bold. She said, I'm just going to pray over this patient, and then you all can leave. And I watched it, and I felt it was the act of stopping people. So the next time we worked on another person who didn't make it, I decided to be bold and stop people from leaving. I just said, could we stop and just for a moment, let's just take a moment to stop and recognize this person in the bed. This person before they came in here were alive. They were interacting with family. They were loved by others. They had a life. If we could just take a moment as a group of people and just stop and just recognize this person in our own way and in silence, just take a pause and take a break.
Practitioners at UVA, ranging from EMTs to nurses to anesthesiologists, are now adopting the pause. In 2013, Dori Fontaine, dean of UVA School of Nursing, talked about the pause during a keynote address at a trauma nursing conference. A nurse there, Michael Day, who is a trauma care coordinator at a hospital in Washington State, took the concept back to Providence Sacred Heart Medical Center in Spokane, where it is now being used. The pause has made a big difference for many at UVA, such as EMT and hospital tech Jack Berner, who says it gives him closure.
Death is a word that you have to use in this setting. You can't use other terms to kind of soften it. But again, it makes it so we can actually view the person as a person rather than as a patient that we see on an everyday basis. You can relate more to the case, saying, you know, it's somebody's father, or their mother, or their sister, or uncle, rather than just somebody you see for 5 minutes. It makes it more real.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
You'll find a link to Mr. Bartel's paper detailing the idea of the pause at WMRA.org. According to a Pew Research Center survey earlier this year, the proportion of Americans who self-identify as having no religious affiliation, called nones, N-O-N-E-S, has increased from about 1 in 6 in 2007 to almost 1 out of every 4 Americans now. Meanwhile, mainstream Christian affiliation is declining, particularly among millennials, the generation born from around 1980 to around 2000. Kara Lofton reports on why this trend is a problem, particularly for Christian churches, and how it is being experienced here in Virginia.
During the summer, the congregation of Rise United Methodist Church in Harrisonburg dwindles to core leadership and the few older members who have made the Friendly City their permanent home. The rest are college students from the area's 4 universities who file into Court Square Theater every Sunday or so during the school year around 10-ish. It's a decidedly young environment. Amanda Garber is the pastor there. She said unlike what people might think, young people aren't walking away from church because community isn't important to them anymore, but rather because they are finding community in places that feel more relevant and authentic to them.
I would say millennials in particular speak a language of community in a very distinctive and powerful way. They just are finding community in more, what they would say, are more authentic, meaningful ways. They are walking away from organized religion, in part because they have experienced it as inauthentic, inhospitable, damaging to themselves and others, hypocritical, and legalistic.
This description of church certainly seems to be accurate for the millennials I have spoken to, who struggle with their church's positions on same-sex marriage, women in leadership, and literal interpretations of Scripture. These young adults are more likely to be found in coffee shops, on hiking trails, or in nature than in a church pew on Sunday morning. But others, such as Adam Miller, youth program assistant at another Harrisonburg church, First Presbyterian, believe no amount of community outside of the church can account for what is found in a, quote, body of believers. But even community isn't enough, he said. The most important piece in faith is a relationship with Christ.
It's something that you hear more and more from, you know, people within different churches, and it's this idea that is, quite honestly, very toxic. But it's this idea that if you live a good life and think happy thoughts, that we'll all get to heaven, and kind of almost removes Christ from part of the equation. And at its core, that is a terrible lie, an absolutely terrible lie. If you look at the teachings of the Bible, you will not find anything that teaches that there is any other way to heaven or to being right in God's eyes other than Christ.
But strong religious affiliation, including an active relationship with Christ, is on the decline, says James Ward, professor of religion at both James Madison and Eastern Mennonite Universities.
We've moved away from a time in which if your parents were Methodist, you were going to be a Methodist. So your religious identity was more or less fixed by the family you were born into, the area you were born into. And religious identity is shifting from this ascribed kind of an identity increasingly toward a more, let's call it, a voluntary or chosen identity. So when this happens, and you couple this with, let's say, less social pressure to be religious, it's not a surprise in some ways that you would see the trends in the data that we see.
Ward says there is still a cohort of millennials, like Miller, who retain as strong a religious affiliation as any generation at any time in history. But others say, since I don't have to be religious, I won't. Miller wonders if the non-religious group doesn't go to church because they buy into the consumeristic American society, which says, if church doesn't have anything to offer me, why would I go? Jordan Garrett grew up in the Baptist church, but worked at Rise as a worship leader while a student at JMU. Now that she has graduated and has moved back home to Richmond, the decision about whether or not to go to church is a little more complicated.
Speaking for me, I think a church should be a community. But from my past experiences, a lot of times it's not a diverse community.
She said even though she loves the church, she thinks it should be criticized because it is letting people down. On the other hand, she agrees with Miller about millennials having a kind of religious apathy.
It's not that they dislike the church. It's more that they don't see its relevance anymore, which is why a lot of churches are freaking out. They're wondering, like, why millennials aren't staying. And I think it's more of an argument if we're not really driving them away, but you're not necessarily giving them a reason to come either.
For WMRE News, I'm Kara Lofton.
It was almost exactly 1 year ago that WMRA aired the first story from our newsroom, a look at what was a new program at the time to protect the environment and also give farmers in the Old Dominion a break from future regulations. 1 year ago this week, Governor Terry McAuliffe and some Virginia lawmakers got together at a farm in Weir's Cave to celebrate the new program, and Andrew Jenner was there for his first story for WMRA.
It's not just any old morning at Cave View Farms, a large dairy in Weir's Cave run by Gerald Garber and two business partners. Over the past few decades, Garber has distinguished himself by adopting numerous best management practices to keep nutrients and sediment from washing off his fields and barnyard and on down to the Chesapeake Bay.
We started about 26 years ago. Actually started on this spot. This was a mud lot.
Now it's a grassy pasture, and it's full of people present for what makes this an unusual morning at Cave View Farms. A sort of farm conservation pep rally celebrating the launch of Virginia's Resource Management Plan program, the state's newest effort to reduce pollution from farms.
I do spend a lot of time on agriculture. Why? I get it. It is a $55 billion a year business for the Commonwealth of Virginia.
That's Governor Terry McAuliffe. Also in attendance, the state Secretary of Agriculture, the Secretary of Natural Resources, a smattering of state legislators, and representatives of several environmental, agriculture, and business groups. To qualify for a resource management plan, a farm has to abide by a number of so-called best management practices that limit nutrient runoff and erosion, fence livestock out of streams, and establish 35-foot buffer strips between streams and cropland or pasture. By the end of 2015, the state hopes to have resource management plans in place on at least 40 farms in Virginia. In return for developing and abiding by one, farmers will get 9 years of immunity from any new state environmental regulations. This makes Virginia one of just 5 states in the country, and the first in the region, to offer a way for farmers to take the guessing out of regulatory compliance. Here's Wilmer Stoneman, Associate Director of Governmental Relations for the Virginia Farm Bureau, the state's largest agriculture advocacy group.
It takes a great deal of time to basically finance those investments and put them in and make sure that they work. And so 9 years is actually a little short, but it's certainly a help.
Echoing that sentiment is Will Baker, president of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
This is a very exciting day. As the governor said, it's a win-win for agriculture and for the environment, for clean water. So whether you're talking trout, whether you're talking health for children to swim, and whether you're just talking about economic activity, clean water is always good. And if it helps the farmer as well, then it's a real win-win.
Just a few short months ago, disagreements between Governor McAuliffe, a Democrat, and Virginia's Republican-controlled legislature nearly led to a government shutdown. And the American Farm Bureau Federation, of which the Virginia Farm Bureau is a member, and the Chesapeake Bay Foundation are on opposite sides of a contentious federal lawsuit over the EPA's latest plan to clean up water pollution in the Chesapeake Bay. On this sunny day, though, at Caveview Farms, everybody all stood together, smiling about clean water and a thriving farm economy, issues, they say, that everyone can feel good about. Here's Baker again.
What's great about this program is that it does bring people together of diverse interests and diverse concerns. And that just is awfully rare in this day and age. So when you can see so many people agreeing as opposed to fighting, you know you've got a winner.
For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and from a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. You, too, can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. See you tomorrow morning.